We are quickly approaching the end of 2024. And if you have not purchased an investment property yet this year, and it's been one of your goals, I need you to listen very closely. I know many of you live in areas where it's so expensive and investment properties seem impossible. I'm talking about some of the big cities. So LA, New York City, maybe even Seattle, Atlanta, places in Florida, and the list goes on. If you know that where you live is too expensive, I need you to lock in right now. Investing out of state changed my life as somebody living in California. I now invest in Ohio and I'm growing my portfolio. It's something that's possible. You just need the right information and execution. So if that's you, if you want to learn how to invest out of state, go to outofstatemoney.com and there is a free training that'll outline the steps for you and help you understand exactly what it takes. So go to outofstatemoney.com or simply go to the link in the description of this episode.
Excuse me, may I talk to you for a second? Yes. This is the Black Real Estate Dialogue. And the purpose of the Black Real Estate Dialogue is to document the journey of an up-and-coming real estate investor and to share the stories of successful Black real estate investors.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast, episode 236. Before we get into this episode, please make sure you leave a rating and review for the show. I always enjoy hearing your feedback, and leaving a rating and review takes maybe 10 to 15 seconds, and it helps us get this message, which you know is a very important message, in front of as many people as possible. This is going to be an amazing episode with Ron Curtis. He's generated over $1 million in revenue on Airbnb. However, it's not in the way that you think. He has a specific way that he leverages Airbnb and supports others with it that has generated this income, and the startup costs are very low. So make sure you listen carefully. If you're looking to figure out different ways to make money without having to put up a whole lot of money while providing a service, I feel like I'm giving away too much already, then definitely stay tuned, buckle your seatbelts, and get ready for this episode. So without further ado, let's get into it. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue. If you are new and you haven't subscribed on YouTube or liked the video, do that right now. If you're on the audio side, make sure you leave a rating and review. Greatly appreciate it and looking forward to hearing your feedback. We're live in DC. Very excited for this episode. I got Ron Curtis with me. Ron, thanks for coming on the show, man.
Thanks for having me, Sam. I appreciate you. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a year in the making.
Definitely.
Definitely, definitely. So, Ron, a lot to talk about today, and I'm excited about this episode because you have what I call an out-of-the-box way of approaching Airbnb and a method to leveraging Airbnb that I really don't see a lot of people talking about. And so right now, we talked off camera, you have 30-plus Airbnbs that you manage, so we'll talk about all of those things. But one, congrats to you for scaling it. It's way more than it was when we met a year ago, so congrats to you on continuing to grind and keep that going forward.
Thank you, man. It's definitely been a journey, one day at a time, one property at a time. And my goal is to have 1,000 plus where I could just manage properties all over the world and make passive income.
Definitely, definitely. So let's talk about Airbnb. Is Airbnb dead? I want your opinion on that, because as you know, there's been murmurings all over the internet, people saying Airbnb is dead. What's your response?
That's a great question. I wouldn't say Airbnb is dead. It may be dead for a certain type of host. And when I say that, there's pretty much two types of hosts. You have amateur hosts and you have professional hosts. So after the pandemic, the travel, a lot of people traveling, the influx of properties messing up supply and demand, anybody thinks they can be an Airbnb host, right? You have a property, you list it, you take some pictures on your iPhone, and you think you're going to make money, but it's way deeper than that, right? When I say professional hosts, those are people who have systems, people, processes in place to help maximize the revenue potential of their business. They're using softwares, they have teams, they're using SOPs, standard operating procedures. They're analyzing their market, they're using revenue management strategies. They're actually undercutting their competition to get those bookings since the supply and demand is thrown off. I'm a living testament. Airbnb isn't dead. I've been doing it for the past 3 years. But a lot of hosts that have no idea what they're doing, respectfully, they're the ones that are, making these posts, these comments saying Airbnb isn't working anymore.
Definitely. And one thing I want to make sure we talk about before we dive into just how you've built everything, you had a very unique start to getting into real estate. So I would love if we could start there and just talk about, buying your first property and just everything you did with that.
All right, cool. So I've always had the passion for house hacking. Right, while I was in college, I wanted to buy a multi-unit family building. Ironically, I worked at a water company, a water utility in DC called DC Water, where Real Estate Randy, Block Shoppers, yeah. he actually worked with me there. He was in HR. And he purchased a 4-unit building, and he told me, Ron, you need to get you some real estate. And he kind of put me onto the house hacking model. So I was infatuated with house hacking. I started researching first-time home buyer programs. And I'm a 9-to-5preneur. I work for the DC government full-time from 9-to-5. And when I punch out of work, I'm actually working on my business. So I was able to leverage first-time home buyer programs and my 9-to-5. I bought a $423,000 house in Washington, D.C., and I only spent $3,700 out of my pocket to do so. I'm a real big on credit, leveraging credit. I used to have a credit repair business. I got $10,000 in a credit card debt, and I got myself out by leveraging debt consolidation loans, and then I taught my community and leveraged and started a credit repair business. So I was actually able to leverage credit to renovate my home and turn my basement efficiency studio into an Airbnb. And from there, I was able to start traveling. And while I'm traveling, I'm getting bookings. I'm getting paid while I'm on vacation, turning my vacations to paycations. And I kind of fell in love with that business model. I cookie cut the process, and I implemented it across multiple properties around the country.
I love that. So what do you remember the program that you use, this down payment assistance program?
Definitely. So in DC, they have several programs. I use a program called EAP. It's for DC government employees. They gave me about $25,000 for down payment and closing cost assistance. And then I use another program called DC Open Doors. They gave me 3% of the closing costs and down payment help, which was around $12,500. So all in all, I was able to purchase my home. They gave me around $37,000 in down payment and closing cost assistance. I actually paid $14.37 in cash to close to buy my house. I put down a $5,000 earnest money deposit, and I end up getting a $1,300 credit back. And one beautiful thing about my deal, they were able to, since I had extra money left over, they were able to buy out my PMI, my mortgage insurance, for the life of the loan. So it was a blessing, honestly. I got a house in an up-and-coming neighborhood of Washington, D.C., and on average, my basement brings in about $3,000 of revenue a month, and it's just a studio efficiency in the hood.
Love that. Love that. So a couple follow-up questions. So you mentioned just buying in the hood. I want to pause there because I commend you for doing that. A lot of people would not be willing to do that, but it helped you get your start. Can you talk more about just the intentionality around there, or was it just what you could afford?
Yeah, definitely. So DC is probably top 10 most expensive real estate markets in the country. I would just say that as a rough average. And growing up, I'm a native Washingtonian, born and raised. Me and one of my close friends, July, we used to make jokes like, yeah, when it's time for us to buy a house, we're going to have to buy a house on the south side. So I actually grew up on the other side of DC, northeast. We call it the clean side. And when it was time for me to purchase homes, you know, in DC, a home starting at $400,000 may not even be turnkey, and you're in like a rough neighborhood. So like, I scouted this home for 3 months. You know, I'm real big on entertaining people, so I wanted a big open space, living room and kitchen, a big backyard. I grew up with a nice backyard, but my main component of my house was a house hackable basement with a private entrance. I scouted my house for 3 months in the wintertime. I closed on my house March 9th. When I first moved in, 2 days later, I come outside, there's dudes posted up outside my house. And ironically, a month after living in my house, I'm watching TV, I'm watching some movie where it was a shootout. I hear guns going off outside, a bullet hits my front door and shatters my glass while I'm watching TV in my living room. I install an $850 bulletproof glass in my living room just so I can feel comfortable when I'm cooking dinner. And then kind of like a war started on my block with some guys that lived in my neighborhood. But ironically, my Airbnb continued to thrive. I continue to make 5-star reviews, and I realized, you know, I'm here for a good time, not a long time, but as long as this house is here, it's going to outlive all of that. And as long as I continue to keep doing good business, it's going to continue to print revenue for me.
Love that. Love that. So what was that experience like setting up the first Airbnb? Because, you know, we see where you are now, but what was it like in the beginning? What was it like just figuring out what to charge, or even like renovating it and just figuring out what you're supposed to do?
Great question. So I kind of became a student in the game. So like I said, I'm a big proponent of credit. I leveraged credit where I took a home renovation loan. I applied for a home renovation loan with a bank called Lightstream. It's a sister bank of SunTrust. I actually learned that from doing rental cars in a credit game. I found out about that bank. They deposited $20,000 in my bank account within 2 hours of applying. I used about 15 of it to buy everything from my Airbnb and do some small light renovations. And from that, my loan may be $300 a month. But like I said, my Airbnb gives me about $3,000 in revenue. You don't see 10x returns per month really much in any market in terms of business, right? So it was definitely a very interesting process because I spent a lot of time just becoming a student of the game, right? I didn't have Airbnb courses that I purchased. I didn't have mentors. Like, it was literally just me and Southeast trying to figure out how can I offset my living costs, right? I listened to this book called Set for Life by Scott Trench. He's the CEO of a Bigger Pockets real estate podcast. And it taught me how to stack my first $25,000 and then how to start house hacking. So in that book, they said the average American, 30% of their housing, 30% of their salary goes to housing. And if you could figure out a way to offset that cost and split it in half, you'll have that much more disposable income to invest in more real estate. So I was able to just start submersing myself in podcasts and YouTube University. Some hidden gems are Facebook groups targeted towards whatever niche you're interested in, because there's a lot of answers hidden inside those haystacks, right? So I kind of just built it. It's really self-made. I built it from just spending time and becoming a savant of the game and just spending time with it every single day.
Got you, man. So you have the Airbnb set up, and then you have two choices. You could figure out how to buy another house in DC and do the Airbnb thing again. And the other choice, which you took, was to get into the co-hosting space. What was that decision-making process like, and why did you choose to look into co-hosting?
I would say it's the cost of acquisition and also the opportunity cost. So prior to doing Airbnb, I did a plethora of other things since the pandemic: credit, taxes, business funding, public speaking, rental cars, Turo, vending machines, drop shipping. I did a lot of different things. And in my community in the DMV area, people knew that from social media and from me helping people start their own businesses, et cetera. And once people saw that I was doing Airbnb, they're like, well, Ron was successful with, you know, rental cars, vending machines. He helped me fix my credit. When people found out I was doing Airbnb and they had properties, it's like, hey, Ron, can you help me start an Airbnb? Whether it was rental arbitrage, or, hey, Ron, I have this house that I want to rent. I don't know how to make money with it. Can you do it for me? And people started literally throwing me the keys. And I realized, wow, okay, I can get, if I manage five people property at 20%, now that's my own 100%. That's my own property, right? And when you look at the overhead that's associated with owning your own property, I'm not paying your mortgage, I'm not paying your rent, I'm not paying utilities, I'm not paying for maintenance and repairs. I'm paying to be a consultant to run your business for a small percentage of every booking that you get. So once it started to compound over time and I started to actually see the numbers, it made more sense for me to continue to do this co-hosting model where I'm managing people and I'm managing their assets for value return.
Got you. How much does it cost to become a co-host? I know people are probably wondering, well, you know, I don't have any money, I can't buy a house. This co-hosting stuff sounds cool. How much is it going to cost me?
Honestly, it will cost you $0 to become a co-host. And I know that may sound cliche. It's so much knowledge and game out here. Once you have the knowledge and you can convince somebody that has a house that you know more than them about Airbnb, they will hand you the keys. So you don't necessarily, the day and age we live in, you don't necessarily have to own a physical property or lease a physical property. I know cleaners who just clean the properties and started to solve pain points for the owners. That's what it's really about. You got people who don't have time, who live far away from their properties, who have the money to invest, but they don't have the time to invest, right? And once you start to solve their problems for them and you become a student in the game, it's way easier for someone to put their trust in you to run their business. And then you can learn on the fly as you go, or you can hire a consultant like me that'll help you have everything you need to start your Airbnb co-hosting business.
That's encouraging, because, you know, things are tough for a lot of people right now. And we haven't even gotten to the nitty gritty yet, but I could already see that this could be something viable that somebody, especially by the end of the episode, could look into as a way to just generate some extra income while also providing a service. And I also like what you said about the fact that you just have to demonstrate your knowledge, which takes, like you did, becoming a student of the game, understanding how things work. And then by the end of this episode, you probably can start hitting some people up and say, I could be your co-host.
Nah, literally. The game we're going to drop in here today, you definitely will be able to leave here and be able to, you know, go have a conversation with someone and convince them that you know what you're talking about with being a co-host.
So let's jump into it. So what are some methods that you use to gain clients? Because I know you mentioned that your first several clients were people you knew and just locally. How did you expand to strangers?
Okay, great question. So I would say business is based on relationships, right? Relationships are worth more than money. So bottom line, doing good business. If you manage one person's property and they tell five people about you, and those five people go tell five people about you, it's a exponential compound effect, right? So I was able to leverage my relationships that I had in business by doing good business with people. Like what I tell people, I sell nights for a living and I help people pay their mortgages. That's what I do, right? And once you're able to solve people's financial problems and you do good business with them, it's nothing for them to refer people to you. Oh, my property manager, oh, my consultant is so great. And it's just like, it spreads like wildfire where by the grace of God, I get leads every week, like organically, by not even putting out content. So that's the first thing, doing good business and, you know, just being a good business person. And then the content aspect of it, you got to market yourself. At first, I wanted to gatekeep some of this information. I realized I was putting out so much free game on so many other topics, and I'm like, whoa, I found this little gold mine. Let me perfect my craft first before I go start telling everybody about it. But now I realize the only way anybody's going to know who I am or what I do is if I market myself. So like I'm real big now on social media, putting out content, doing podcasts, and just teaching people. Like I taught some college kids today about Airbnb, a summer youth employment program for the Department of Insurance and Banking for DC while I was on the clock. They let me do it, and trying to put them on the game early on. I told them about rental cars as well. So it's just like not being afraid to jump off the porch and just putting yourself out there so you can be seen.
Are there any resources that or places people can go to start generating some leads and finding some clients? Let's say they don't have anybody who has a arbitrage situation or who has a property they own and wants to rent out the whole thing or part of it. Where can they go to start gaining some leads?
Facebook. So Facebook is probably the largest app in the world. More people probably on Facebook than any other app. I don't know if I can fact check myself for that, but the reason I say that, you got to think big, you got to think global. I've managed properties in Tulum, Mexico. I've never stepped foot in Tulum in my life because I met people on Facebook. I built a team in Facebook of Spanish cleaners, Spanish airport transportation people, private chefs, masseuses, all those things just by leveraging Facebook. And one thing that I really love about Facebook is Facebook has groups of any niche that you're interested in. And almost every major state and every major city has an Airbnb Facebook group specific to Airbnb. And every single day, hosts are going on there asking questions, amateur hosts, right? And if you just lay back in the cut, you turn on your post notifications, they're out and you start answering people's questions, providing value, somebody's gonna see that, then they're gonna slide in your DMs. The person who you answer may not even respond to you, but you'll become a top contributor, and then the algorithm will start, just like Instagram, if you like sports all day, that's all it shows you, it's only gonna start showing you Airbnb leads. So if you don't know where to start to find leads, and you wanna get into this game, get into these Facebook groups and answer as many people's questions as possible. Whether you know the answer or not, go on Google, go on ChatGPT, and just start answering people's questions.
As far as paperwork, so let's say you find a client, you know, if somebody, I know you talking to somebody just before today. So let's say you close that deal. What comes next in terms of like paperwork, onboarding and all that stuff? How does that look like?
Yeah, so you definitely want to get a contract. I started out with like a basic agreement, like on ChatGPT or another, I can't think of the other website that'll draft a basic agreement. But at the level I'm on now, I actually have a attorney generated agreement where, you know, it has insurance in there that protect me, it protects my business and my interests. And a lot of times I don't budge on my agreement because it was created for me and my business based on all the pitfalls and trials that I've experienced so far. Once somebody signs an agreement, I charge a consultation fee because it's my time that I'm spending to come to your property, to use my expertise, to onboard your property, to get it live, to hire my cleaners, my handyman, my interior designers. You're getting access to all of my resources, right? But I would say the biggest thing in terms of paperwork is making sure whatever state or city that you're in, that one, if you need a license, you qualify for the license. And if you don't need a license, you know, that you onboard your property correctly. But pretty much after you sign the agreement, you get your license, whether it's the interior designed or furnished, we get it clean, professional photos, and once you hand me the keys, I'll take over from there.
What have you had any? What kind of pushback have you received on the agreement? And the reason I'm asking is because this is a teachable moment. It's always important to protect your interests. And so I like that you mentioned the contract. I like that you mentioned the insurance because, you know, stuff happens. But what kind of pushback have you received from people where maybe you just didn't work out because you don't want to agree?
I mean, the most pushback I see is financials, right? Why are you charging a consultation fee? I'm a consultant. If you go to a lawyer, they're going to charge you a consultation fee. If you go to a CPA or your tax person, they're going to charge you a consultation fee. I'm a subject matter expert in my field. And I like I told somebody that I don't work for free. And, you know, it's a reasonable cost. Sometimes I let people split the cost. Sometimes I let people take it out of the first bookings. But at the end of the day, I've done enough. I've done my share of free things, right? And then the percentages, right? So when people hear property management, they think like the traditional 6 month, long, 12 month Section 8 long-term tenant where you're anywhere from 9 to 12%. But what I have to, you know, tell people, I'm charging 18 to 20% because I'm running a 24/7 hotel business. And I'm taking on all the stress. I'm taking on all the headaches. I'm taking on all the issues that come with that. And I also have a team. It's not just me. I have a team of people who I have to pay weekly. I pay monthly. You know, to handle all of these tasks and work for me. So it's like, if you just tell me, hey, can we do 15%? I'll ask you, under what reason and what's your justification for that? Because that's just a number that sounds better to you. You don't even know how much money you can make, right? And then when they start working with me, they're making more money than they've ever made. And it's like, oh, yeah, yeah. But it's like, come on, I know what I'm doing. So, yeah, I would just say financials are the biggest pushbacks because most people don't understand business and most people don't understand money. And when you tell somebody like 18%, I need 20%, it sounds like such a big number, but they don't realize that they're going to be making more money than they made it, that they make it their 9 to 5 leveraging their asset.
Great point. Something else that I was thinking about is, so you mentioned the contract, you mentioned the consultation fee, and you mentioned that you just tell them straight up, like, hey, I don't work for free. This is the reason why I'm charging you to set everything up. Did you have to grow to that, or were you like that from day one, charging the consultation fee?
No, definitely. I actually just recently started charging the consultation fee. From day one, I was more so lenient. Because I was trying to get my foot in the door. And like, I didn't know, you know, all that I know now. Now I'm at a point where I have social proof and I have the metrics behind it to back what I'm doing. It's like, okay, now it makes sense to charge. Another reason why you always have to charge people, and I would say charge people from the gate. It doesn't have to be $1,000. I mean, I've had people pay me $2,000 for a consultation, $1,500, $1,000 for a phone call, for an hour phone call with me, right? So once you realize, okay, there are people out here who will pay for my time, right? But I wasn't always like that. And I recently realized you have people like that will try to take advantage of you. You have people who will take your kindness for weakness. And what I realized when you get somebody something for free, they don't value it, right? But if you charge them, now they have skin in the game. Now if it's a little bit more serious to them. I don't like to deal with people that waste my time because time is one thing we can't get back. We can always get more money. But at the same time, once you make that payment and you make that non-refundable consultation fee, that's how I know we locked in. I know I'm gonna show up and do my job. And that's a way that you make sure that person doesn't try to run off on you or that person doesn't waste your time in a sense.
Do you feel like since you started doing that, you have higher quality clients that you're working with?
Yes. And the reason being is it creates leverage. Very rarely do I reach out to somebody and say, hey, can I manage your property? 99% of my clients reach out to me, find my number, call me, were referred to me. So it's like, okay, I'm at a point now where, like, humbly speaking, like, you need me. I'm doing good where I'm at right now, and I'm scaling, and I'm being more selective of who I do business with, because I realize you can't do business with everybody, because all money isn't good money. And earlier on, I'm like, ooh, I need that property. And it's like quality over quantity. Everybody, like, I'm more so focused on who's my avatar client. Okay, I've been doing this long enough. Who is somebody the type client I know I don't want to work with that's going to cause, you know, turmoil and stress? And that's just kind of where I'm at right now on my journey.
And a lot of people will fight you on the fact that people don't value free stuff, but it is a fact. You don't take it as seriously. If you have to invest money in something, you're going to try to get your return back, or at least pay attention to what, you know, what the person's teaching or what they're doing or whatever the case is. And there are those select few who will go all the way through on something that they got for free, but 99% of people will not execute on information they got for free. I'm sorry to say it.
That's
like
true.
The majority of people, and there's nothing wrong with this, the majority of people need an incentive. You need to have, to your point, skin in the game, some sort of investment you've made within reason that you can afford. But if you didn't, then you would have already done it with all the free information out there, right? They would have just went on YouTube where there's thousands and hundreds of thousands of videos on what you do and just done it off of that, right? But to your point, it's the reason they came to you. So you make the investment and, you know, test this out. So I appreciate you mentioning that, because that's something that people don't really want to talk about, to be honest with you.
Yeah. And it's something I recently learned. I realized, okay, I had a few clients try to take advantage of me and I was nothing but nice to them, nothing, just morally the person that I am. And I realized, okay, something got to shift. Mm-hmm. And it just, like you said, people value it more. They definitely value it more. When you spend money, you got to recoup that investment, and you're more inclined to make it work too. If it's just free, oh, he's just working for free, it works. Like, I want to work with people who are interested in, you know, want to change their lives as well.
Absolutely. So let's talk about the avatar. Let's talk about the avatar, and let's talk about who you don't want to work with. And the reason I want to talk about that is because for those watching, they're probably thinking, okay, we're talking about all this stuff, and it sounds like I need to figure out, like, who is an ideal client. It's going to be different for everybody, but I think just a general idea of what you look for and what you try to avoid will be helpful.
Gotcha. So I'll start with what I learned to avoid. So, like, a lot of times people would have reached out to you and then start fishing for information. So, like, the clients that I now want to avoid are clients who give me red flags out the gate that they want to try to cut me out and do it themselves at some point. I don't have a problem with you if you come up to me up front doing that, but if it's like we sign a contract and then you start, you know, trying to do things your way and change things from the contract, those are like red flags out the gate. And people who kind of like waste time, people who drag their feet on things, people who are indecisive, can't make decisions. I'm giving you all the resources that you need to be successful and you're playing double dutch, right? You know, hey, have you applied for your license yet? That's the only thing we're waiting on. Oh, no, I didn't call them. Oh, I got to email them. And it's like, like, I have so many clients, it's like, you might have fell to the bottom of the priority list because you're not holding up your end of the bargain, right? People that I do want to work with are people who are passionate about investing in real estate. People who don't have the time to do it, right? Working with people who are, I would call them pain points. They love the business. Like I've probably taken over more people's Airbnbs than I've signed Airbnbs from the jump, because people just don't have the bandwidth to do it. And I'm the person that will run everything for you, where like my ideal client is, here, Ron, take the keys. I don't ever want to see Airbnb. Just make sure the money good every 2 weeks. Like that's my ideal client. Not, hey Ron, did you bring the trash cans in today? Like I work for the DC government full time, and I'm a boss myself. I don't consider myself a worker. I've never called any supervisor a boss. And when you're micromanaging me as a client, I had to, like, you know, let people know we're in a partnership together. I don't work for you. We work together. It's like Shark Tank, an equity deal, 15, 85, 20, 80. We're working together because you need me just like I need you. And I realized the importance of setting boundaries right out the gate. So something I'm actually developing right now is like a client personality matrix model. So I know I said in this business, I sell nights and I pay people's mortgages, right? But I'm really in the people business. I'm dealing with guests. who've spent their hard-earned money to stay at whatever property. You have entitled guests. You have guests who don't care. You don't know who's staying in your Airbnb. So just think of that like an unlimited personality type, right? You can't control that, but you can control who you work with. So now what I'm doing with my clients, I can't really change anything about clients I currently have. I can just put them into certain boxes based on their personality type. But now I'm starting to identify who is this client I'm potentially about to work with. So if I'm coming to your house to see your property, you think you're about to interview me? No, I'm interviewing you also with the questions that I'm asking to see what is your management style, what's your personality type, to see if this even makes sense to me, because all money isn't good money, and some people will stress you out to the point where you say, man, is this even worth it? And I've had to fire some clients before, mm-hmm. like respectfully, hey, you know, this isn't working. And sometimes you have to do that to protect your peace and also protect your business, because like I said, there's a certain type of client I want to work with. And if you show me out the gate, even from the first conversation after a networking event, I'm like, oh no, I can't work with this person. It's okay. There's some host out there that will work with you, but I'm just not the one.
So Ron, you're working your 9 to 5 and you also have this thriving business from 5 to 10 and probably later some days. Mm-hmm. So I want to talk about two things. I want to talk about just the technology systems and things that you need to use just to run the business efficiently first, and then we'll talk about the team.
Okay. All right. So when you're managing multiple properties, you definitely want to have a tech stack. And a tech stack is just pretty much the different softwares that you use to run your business, right? So I use multiple CRM systems to manage my day-to-day activities, to track, you know, claims, things of that nature. I use something called a channel manager that allows me to list multiple properties on multiple platforms where the calendars are synced so you can avoid double bookings, the messaging, the pricing, and things of that nature. I use revenue management software, similar to like how hotels' prices fluctuate daily based on supply and demand. So I use different softwares that help me maximize revenue for my owners. I use a plethora of other different softwares, whether it's for social media marketing, whether it's for sourcing cleaners or handymen and things of that nature. But pretty much in my day-to-day, I mainly focus on my CRMs and my channel manager to engage with the guests and also to maximize revenue potential.
Got you. What channel? So the channel manager basically helps you post on like Airbnb, VRBO, et cetera, at the same time, and everything is all synced together. Are there different types, or is there a specific one that you typically use?
Yeah, so I used to work, when I worked in the DC government in my previous role, I was a data analyst and I managed systems. So what I realized, a lot of these softwares are all the same. Some of them just have different bells and whistles. So one of the biggest ones on the market is Guesty. You have Owner Res, you have Uplisting. I use Hospitable. I've used and demoed all of those different ones. But in terms of ease of access, in terms of price point, and in terms of their customer service, I really like Hospitable. So that's the one that I use.
What about for pricing? Is there a certain, what tool do you recommend?
Similar to that, they have Beyond Pricing, Wheelhouse Pricing. One of the biggest ones in the market is Price Labs, and that's actually the one that I use, Price Labs.
Gotcha. So we got pricing software. We got software to kind of manage all the bookings and stuff. Is there any other technology that you use? I might have forgot something.
Definitely, yeah. I use two different CRMs. I use Monday.com. Monday.com is pretty much like a CRM project management software where it's mainly for my team. And I also use something called Go High Level. Go High Level is a software I've been using for about 4 to 5 years now. And it's very dynamic. It lets me do a lot of different things in terms of automations, websites, email marketing campaigns, things of that nature, and everything is housed under one system. So those are pretty much the main core softwares that I use.
How do you keep yourself from not being distracted by the business when you have to focus on work and just getting stuff done? What has that been like, just developing that over the last couple of years?
That's a great question. So as a CEO, especially in the beginning, you wear a lot of hats, right? You wear all of the hats, right? Similar to Steve Jobs or Jeff Bezos, they weren't always, you know, not shipping out orders or working on iPhones, right? So what I've had to do, I was able to use my 9 to 5 organizational hierarchy And I was able to make that transferable to my business. So I work for the DC government. We have a customer service department, HR department, maintenance department. And what I did was one day I sat down and I wrote out my different departments, right? And I started to hire people accordingly, right? So in my job, we have a chief of staff. I actually hired a chief of staff to manage all of my staff, right? I hired operations managers, right, to manage the day-to-day activities of the business, the cleaners, the customer service team, maintenance department, right? I have a Rolodex of all different types of handyman just in case when things happen. I have things going on right now. AC just went out. I got an HVAC guy at a house right now. So I realized in order for me to scale and grow as fast as I would like, I have to stop working in the business and I have to work on the business, right? And now that I'm generating more revenue, I'm able to now pay people and also pay for systems to help automate that process and then allow me to take myself out of the business.
That makes a lot of sense. So as far as building the team, like, who are these people? Where do they come from? Where do you go to find them?
Definitely. So 90% of my staff are virtual assistants. I've used virtual assistants in all of my businesses for the past 3 to 4 years. And once I got into the short-term rental space, I realized, wow, I can just pay a virtual assistant to do this. So what I had to do was write down all the tasks that I do in a day-to-day in a week in my business. And then I started to highlight the things that I don't want to do. And then I started to create roles for those tasks that I don't want to do. And I started to hire accordingly. So a lot of people, you know, where can I find virtual assistants, right? People go on Upwork, people go on Fiverr, people go on online.ph, right? And I looked at that as like the marked up virtual assistants, right? I get straight to it. I use Facebook groups again, right? So I go on Facebook. There's hundreds of Facebook groups with hundreds and thousands of people in there that are virtual assistants. And I have virtual assistants that work for me all over the world. I have virtual assistants in Philippines. I have virtual assistants in Pakistan. I have virtual assistants in Nigeria. I have virtual assistants in Colombia, South America. And it's very advantageous to do that because you're working on different time zones, right? When I go to sleep at nighttime at 8 p.m. when I clock out for the day, my virtual assistants in the Philippines are waking up at 8 a.m., right? People in Pakistan have a 24-hour customer service team, right? They respond to all inquiries around the clock, right? I have people in Africa that do different things for me. I hired people in South American countries to help with the language barrier that I have with my U.S. Spanish-speaking cleaners, right? So I just started to leverage economies of scale. Our dollars go a lot further in those countries. And these people rely on these weekly payments that I'm giving them. They're making more money working with me part-time than they would working a full-time job, whatever they would be doing in their country.
I love that you mentioned the payment because I know for a fact people are like, oh, he's paying people not enough wages who are abroad and all this stuff. But you got to remember, like you said, our dollar in many of those countries goes so much further. And I'm sure, you know, it's helping them take care of their families and take care of their obligations and live a decent quality of life. So I really appreciate that you mentioned that because I know, you know how people are. People are going to make assumptions, but, you know, obviously you're doing something different. How many people roughly would you say it takes to run this whole thing?
It's a great question. It's probably like 10 people on my team. So that's 10 different payrolls, 10 different families I'm helping feed, 10 different opportunities that where I'm actually helping them learn about the business. And then I always outsource business to them. I got a guy, he has a 4-unit building in Noma, right? And I manage his Airbnb. The other three are Section 8. His property managers suck. I don't want to manage your Section 8 tenants. Hey, you have a virtual assistant for me that can help me manage my tenants and manage my property manager. Yeah, here go my girl. I've been working for 3 years. Boom, right? I got a cleaner in Ocean City. He called me 2 days ago. Hey, Ron, hey, you were talking about virtual assistants a while back. I'm at a point in my business where I need help with admin tasks. I need to stop working in the business. I can't even send out invoices. I can't track. Do you have somebody for me? Oh, yeah, I can send you my girl. She knows all about this. She does this for me, right? And now I'm giving them more hours and more opportunity and the skill set where they can now market themselves to other people like me. And I give them bonuses. I give them pay raises. And I actually take care of them. If they have a bill that they reach out to me that they need paid, for the most part, I pay it. One of my staff would be like, you need to stop tricking on them. I'm not tricking on them. I'm actually helping them advance their life, helping their quality of life. Right now, there's typhoons in Philippines. Mm. They're sending me videos of, hey, Ron, my house is flooded right now, but I'm still making calls. I sent her some money so her and her family could get out of her house for that time period and go somewhere dry. And it's like things people don't think about that when it comes to like, or like, it was a heat wave in the Philippines about a month or two ago where it was probably 130 degrees. She told me in Celsius. When I looked it up, I'm like, wow. And she said people are driving and passing out and having heat stroke. It's so hot, right? They don't live near any water. Her fan, she sends me a picture. The only fan in their apartment dies, right? In their little shack dies. I just sent her money to buy a new fan. Like, so it's like things like that. Like I said, relationships are worth more than money. It's not slave labor. It's not anything like that. I'm building this team so they can grow with me. It's not just like, oh, you're doing a task for me. Like, no, I actually care about you. I had one of my assistants, her mom fell down and broke her leg. She sent me, she literally sent me the fracture, the time, date, stamp, all of that stuff. And I sent her like $400 in American money so her mom could get a splint on her leg. Her son had some type of sickness where he was coughing and he had a fever for like a week or two. And she sent me the paperwork and sent me how much his medicine costs. I sent her the money for it. Like, and that's money that, not saying you have to work, to make this labor back. Like, you're indebted to me. Like, no, that is me helping you with things that are going on in your life, because you help make my life easier every single day.
Wow, salute to you for that, because you don't have to do that, and it says a lot that you are willing to do that for those who you're helping in all these different countries and working with. And I guarantee, and you check me on this if I'm wrong, I guarantee it makes them even more loyal and want to work even harder because they're so appreciative of you just helping them out. You know, so that's amazing, man.
Yeah, and it's bigger than business to me. Like, in the last example, I'll say, just to be real, like, one of my assistants, she said it was so hot and her child wouldn't stop crying, she was about to commit suicide. And I messaged her and asked her to do a task for me. And she sent me this long message saying, Ron, you just saved my life. I was literally about to take my life because I didn't know what I was doing. I'm sitting here hot as I don't know what. And you sent me a task to do, and that took my mind off of it. She called me her angel. And like, stuff like that is deep, because we take life for granted over here. We stressed about going to work and sitting at a computer, or, you know, but it's like people really having to make those life or death decisions. Like, I helped one of my virtual assistants start a food truck business. And like, people call me Wavy. I used to have a catering business called Wavy Plates. And they call their food trucks Pears. She made a truck and she named it Wavy Pears. And she's selling a special soup that's native in her country on the side of the road. And she sends me a picture. Look, we're growing. Remind me of Diner Dash. I'm like, wow, you got a table and chairs now? And it's just like, that's the type of stuff that I want to do. Like, that's bigger than Airbnb to me. Just impacting other people's life, because that's what I was put on this planet to do.
Man, you about to make me sit over here and cry.
Yeah, it's getting deep. Some onions, somebody cutting onions in here. But nah, that's the stuff I'm passionate about. Like, helping people, adding value, doing good business, and just leaving my mark on the world, really.
Absolutely, man. Wow. I'm at a kind of a loss for words, man. But I think that's beautiful. And everything's not perfect here, right, in this country. But people really don't understand, generally speaking, how good we have it, bro. Like, we have so much more. Like, my parents, they're from Haiti, and so I mean, I know where they came from and what's going on over there now, and fam, like, we got to be grateful, man, for what we do have. You know, everybody watching, you don't have everything. Maybe you're going through a tough time, maybe you lost your job, but for some people it's like way worse than whatever we're going through. So man, thank you for sharing that. I appreciate that.
Thank you, man. That's what it's about. Impact over income. That's how I look at it.
So what challenges would you say you faced in the business? You know, because I want people to understand everything doesn't always go as planned. Like, things come up, and to prepare for, just to push through some of those challenges. But what are some of those challenges that you've had over the years, and maybe even some recent ones?
Challenges. So one of the biggest challenges is like learning to take your hands off everything. right? So if you built this baby from inception and now it's growing, you have to get comfortable with taking your hands off of it and putting people that you trust in place to help manage it for you, right? And that's been one of the biggest challenges, but now I'm starting to see the value of it, the benefit of it, right? I hired a chief of staff. I've hired bookkeepers now. I'm not doing the books. I actually just hired my mom. Like, my mom just got forced into retirement from the DCPS. They rifted her, which was wild to me. Yeah, it's wild. But she was a business manager in the elementary school. She loved the kids. She was stressing over that. She just had her, I think, 65th birthday last week. And now next week we're starting training. So now she can manage my bookkeeping and finance team. And now that frees up my time at the end of the month where I'm not crunching numbers, right? So just like learning to take my hands off of everything so I can really be a CEO. Because a CEO is supposed to be working on scaling the business, finding new business, networking to bring on more business, right? And that's all I want to do. All I want to do is have conversations like this, literally. I don't want to be in the business anymore. And then it's like, what made it so hard? It's like, wow, I don't really know this person like that, but I just hired them. And now I'm about to get them keys to my kingdom. Like, and it's a beautiful thing. When I went to St. Martin for a week for my birthday, I literally gave the keys away. And I wasn't bothered while I was gone. They handled, and it was chaotic when I left, right? And the beautiful thing about it, when I came back, I had a whole breakdown of, you need to fix this. This didn't go right. We need to implement a process for this. So they saw things that I didn't see because I was so in it and I was used to operating in chaos. So that's one of the hardest things. And then just understanding people's personality types in business. Those are probably the two hardest things, like growing the business, spending time with it. I love doing that. I do that every single day. So that's like a byproduct of success for me. Learning the technology, listening to podcasts, networking with like-minded individuals. That's what I'm really good at. But just learning the people aspect of it and then being okay with just taking a step back sometimes.
That's real. That's real. One thing I meant to ask is, for the people who are international, how does it work? Is there paperwork? Like, is it more of like, you know, written agreements? Like, what does that process look like? I would assume it's not as straightforward as, you know, working with somebody in the States.
Yeah, so in a short-term rental business, you don't really have access to sensitive data. So you don't have access to people's birthdays, social security numbers, things of that nature. You can hire an agency who has all those security clearances and things like that. If you, like, let's say you were a health insurance company or a credit repair company or something like that, you would want to hire, you know, people who have those assurances. You can do background checks on VAs and things of that nature. But when I'm hiring these VAs off of Facebook, a lot of times they're newly college grads looking for jobs. They're people who already are in this space and have experience, and I interview them. I don't make them sign agreements. They don't make me sign agreements. It's literally, hey, these are the tasks that I need you to do. This is how much I'll pay you, and we can lock in. And literally every Friday, I send them their payment through PayPal or Remitly or whatever, and then, or monthly, I pay them monthly, depending on what our agreement is. And I guess it's kind of like a trust system. They have very limited access to certain systems. So like, they may have view only access. They maybe can see the calendar, but not the price. They may be able to message a guest, but they can't go alter a reservation. So it's just like, depending on who you are in my company, I have those levels of access in there.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's probably something people are thinking about. But I also think it's part of taking your hands off the situation, and you put the measures in place, but eventually you train the people, you got to trust them to go and do the job, and hopefully it works out. So it's good that you mentioned that.
Definitely. And it's like, you gotta, when you interview these people, you got to ask them specific questions. You have to see if they're a good fit for the role. Like, an example, like, I literally just hired somebody to apply for 100% remote jobs for me, because I don't have the time or the bandwidth to do it. But if I can pay you and I give you my resume and I show you how to go remix a cover letter or a resume on ChatGPT specific to a job description, I just bought back my time, and I could potentially, you know, get a job offer from that. So it's just providing them with the tools and resources that they need to be successful at the job. And I realized early on, I just used to delegate, hey, do this and figure it out, right? And that's not setting them up for success. I have to spend some time with them. I have to train them. I have to hire somebody to train them, right? So they can learn faster, and then they can start, you know, being successful with whatever tasks that are assigned to them.
What are a couple of the most important questions you generally ask anybody who's interviewing?
So one of the first things I do, I have them send me. So like the first thing is, if I make a job post and you don't respond to it exactly with the things that I ask, that just shows me off the rip that you don't follow directions. If I make a job post, then I could wake up the next morning with 100 messages, right? And if you didn't follow everything that I asked you to do, send me a voice note. I want to see how your English is, right? Send me your pay rate, right? Sometimes they'll throw out outlandish pay rates, right? Like outlandish things, right? More than I make in the US. And I'm like, okay, you're not my avatar, right? But I mean, it's pretty general. Once I get them on the phone and they say they have experience, I'm just asking them questions to see, do they really know what they're talking about? Or are they just trying to like, sometimes they're reading right off of a script. So it's like, they filter themselves out. So if you don't send me the voice message so I can understand how clear your English is, maybe I need you to call guests and greet them before they check in. If your pay rate is already outside of my anticipated budget, I ask them to send me their resume. If your resume isn't up to par based on what I'm looking for, you just kind of, it's kind of like the U.S. job market, cold pile, hot pile. I schedule interviews with them. If it's good, I'll outsource them to my chief of staff. She'll meet with them, see how they are, and if it's a good fit, we onboard them. Usually it's really good in terms of like the people that we pick, because we're not asking them to do too high level things. And then as they get that, then we add, you know, more to their plate, increase their pay, et cetera, until they're comfortable in what the role is.
So I know, of course, you need cleaners, handy people, different folks. Do you go to Facebook to find those folks as well in the different cities where you manage properties?
So cleaners, there's a website called Turno. You pretty much put in an address, put in a property, and then it'll start sending you bids for different cleaners in that market. A lot of times those are independent cleaners. I don't really like working with independent cleaners because I've had my experience with them. But I wouldn't be opposed to it. That's how I started. That's a great way to find cleaners in any market. You can always Google cleaning companies in whatever market that you're in, so you can find different cleaners and things of that nature. Handyman, since I'm based in DC and I've been doing this for a while, I have all the, every time I see a handyman or work with one, I, you know, retain their information. But a lot of people use TaskRabbit or Thumbtack to find handyman, you know, or plumbers, electricians, HVAC, things of that nature. But once we start doing business together and you do good business, I just lock you in, and I actually have like an Excel sheet that has all of my, you know, contacts that I use for different markets.
What markets are you in right now?
Right now, I'm in D.C., Maryland, Virginia. I'm in North Carolina. I'm in New Jersey. What other markets am I in right now? I've been in Texas. I've been in Tulum. I've been in California. I've been in Atlanta. I've been in Mississippi, Louisiana. I've been in Miami, Florida. Sorry about that. I've been in Vegas. So what I've noticed, I want to now niche down and focus primarily on the DMV market, mm-hmm. And really take over this market. And from there, continue to scale. Like I work with a lot of clients in different states and cities based on social media. I'm in Galveston, Texas right now. I got a client out there, but I'm realizing, wow, I can focus a lot of my energy in the DMV and just take over this whole area, because there's nobody doing this here but me, really. And like, I'm now hearing my name brought up in real estate networking events and conferences when I'm not there. People call me, I was at this event and they said that you were the Airbnb guy. And because I used to do credit and I have such a extensive network with realtors and lenders, and now they all know I do Airbnb, I'm like the Airbnb guy in the real estate world. So I said, let me start here. Let me stop reaching places I can't see and can't touch. And focus more on the DMV area because it is lucrative. But my goal is to expand to other cities where Airbnb is more profitable in terms of markets that aren't seasonal. DC is seasonal. When it's cold, it gets slow. But markets like Orlando, Florida, where there's Disney World, is live all year round. And my goal is just to get my brand and my expertise to those hosts in those different areas.
Love it. So as we wrap up, if you could, someone who's watching this, be like, all right, I saw this whole interview, I want to try this. What are just a few steps they should take to get closer to doing it? And yeah, I say we do that.
First thing I would say was start with the free resources, right? Facebook groups, YouTube University, podcasts, just immerse yourself in that, right? And once you get a feel for it, it seems like something you do or you like. The second thing I would say is make an investment. So we just said, like, people don't take things that are free for granted. You'll take that YouTube video for granted. But if you go pay a consultant like myself $1,000 to learn the game, you may take it a little bit more seriously. Now you have someone to help you. Or you go buy a $300 course that teaches you how to do it, you may take it a little bit more serious. From there, like I said, with co-hosting, you pretty much have all the tools and resources that you need to be successful. Once you learn the knowledge, right? Once you submerge yourself, whether you're in that with that consultant or whether you're learning that free information. If you want to leverage rental arbitrage, which is like subleasing a property and renting on an Airbnb, it's a little bit more dynamic. You want to understand, you know, your business structure. You want to understand business funding. You also want to understand market research and how to make sure you're investing in the right property. But the bottom line is do your due diligence and spend time with this so you can understand what exactly you're getting into. And don't just chase the money, because the money is going to be a byproduct of whatever you do. It's just based on how fast can you connect with someone who has a property and how can you wow them based on the information that you have.
Last question, important question. You mentioned, you know, your mom kind of being pushed to retirement. What does it mean to you to give her something new and a new direction to go in this next phase of her life? What does that mean to you?
It actually means everything to me. So my mom in college, I have two younger brothers. I went to Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, VCU. And my freshman year in college, I went to school. I think my college was about $30,000 a year. At 18, I have no idea how much $30,000 a year is, right? So I asked her, I'm like, hey, mom, first year was great. She showed me the bill. She showed me everything, how much my dorm cost, the food cost, all of that. And I asked her, mom, if I can come home and go somewhere local, I go to community college because I want my brothers, Karan and Kai, to go to college. And she was like, no, don't worry about it. My dad, he was a six-figure earner, a principal the majority of my life. She said, you know, dad, he pretty much covers all of the home bills. And I wake up every day and go to work to pay your college tuition. And when she said that to me after my freshman year in college, it changed my whole life, because I'm like, wow, you wake up every day and go to work to pay for me to go to school. So I started taking that seriously. And honestly, my goal has been to retire my mom. And it kind of irritated that they forced her out of retirement before I could do it. But now, since she has the free time and she's not stressed anymore, now I can show her this business because she's interested in it. And now, like, working with my mom is going to be amazing, because I really want to get money with my loved ones and my friends. So I wanted to become a family business, my dad, my mom, my little brothers. And I know for a fact short-term rentals and midterm rentals like Airbnb are going to retire me and my family.
Great way to end it. Great way to end it. So before we wrap, let everyone know where they could find you, where they could follow you, where they could reach out to you if they want to talk and just learn more about what you do and keep in touch.
All right. Everyone, the best way to get in contact with me is on Instagram. And my Instagram is Wavy, W-A-V-Y, _stay. That's the name of my company, Wavy Stay. So again, W-A-V-Y, _STAY. If you send me a DM, if you follow me, I'll follow you back. I'll message you. I'm revamping my website. My website will be in my bio probably by August. And you'll be able to book consultations and see everything that I do. But that's the best way to find me. And then also on YouTube, I have a YouTube channel. My name on YouTube is Dr. Financial, DOCTOR_financial. And I drop a lot of game on there as well. But those are the best places to get in contact with me.
I appreciate you coming on, man. I know they're going to get a whole lot of value out of this episode. So I'm excited to put it out.
All right. Thanks, Sam. Thanks for having me, man. Like I said, it was a year out and I'm glad that, you know, we were able to be in the same city and make this happen.
Absolutely. I don't forget, man. And thank you to everyone for watching another episode or listening to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue. Definitely make sure to like this video, subscribe to the channel. If you're on YouTube, if you're on the audio side, please be sure to leave a rating and review. We greatly appreciate it. Thank you all so much. And I'll talk to you soon.
thank you for listening to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast. Remember to follow us on Instagram at Black Real Estate Dialogue. And be sure to leave us 5 stars and a review on your favorite podcast listening platform. Until next time.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.